Eric Rudolph, America's forgotten right-wing terrorist. Why talk about Eric Rudolph? Well, timing. The Winter Olympics are occurring. Rudolph kicked off his bombing campaign against what he called elitist socialist Marxists, abortionists, and globalists during the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. It's a compelling story. It's one of the largest prolonged domestic terrorist attacks of the modern era. And while events were covered during the time, it's largely been forgotten as a cultural touching point. It's not something that's used for comparison in the modern era. And that's a theme with right-wing terrorist movements and attacks, really prior to the Trump era. Rudolph has told us what he thinks, and he's done so ad nauseum. While Jim Acheson from a previous episode left the manifesto, it was fairly short and to the point. He was radicalized by right-wing media to hate anyone different than himself and believed liberals were socialists and communists, terrorist sympathizers, so he shot them. Rudolph, on the other hand, has self-published hundreds of pages of what can only be described as horrible content, and I wouldn't suggest anyone seek it out, as it's mostly hosted on a site run by a DOJ Homeland Security labeled domestic terrorist organization. However, since it exists on that platform and elsewhere, we have a much deeper understanding of Rudolph's political, social, and religious views, which are frightfully not too far off from mainstream conservative narrative in 2022. We'll go over all of this along with describing his bombings using eyewitness testimony and reports from the era. Significance. It's important to acknowledge right-wing extremist action and belief in an era of mainstream acceptance for right-wing radicalism. Eric Rudolph provides unique insight into both from the perpetrator's perspective. Big picture, what are some ideas that he targeted? Socialism, one world government, Marxism, feminism, people and things that he targeted, non-Christians, LGBTQ community members, abortion clinics. And we'll see that this is all tied together from the sexual liberation of the 60s leading to women's control over their bodies and how that affected traditional family units to integration in schools, manifesting in critical race theory style grievances, to LGBTQ acceptance being seen as eroding the family structure as tied to Marxism's attempts to destroy Western civilization. The key thoughts include casting so-called egalitarians and people just seeking equality for others as Marxist totalitarians, gun rights, anti-feminism, anti-globalism, one world government conspiracies, lumping all of this into generalizations that we could just say are anti-socialist. We see this type of rhetoric everywhere today, from Republican lawmakers and campaign ads to social media personalities ranging from Jordan Peterson to Tim Pool. The insight that Rudolph provides really brings out into the open these connections from mainstream right-wing figures to extremism. And this is important to understand moving forward as Republican lawmakers and talking heads continue to try and diminish manifestations of this mainstreamed right-wing extremism, such as the January 6th Capitol insurrection, ties between right-wing militias and gangs like the Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, Proud Boys, just name a few, and political operatives. Plots to kidnap Democratic officials being dismissed and forgotten. And the modern Republican Party, really beginning with the Tea Party movement, paving the way for MAGA Trumpism, adopting more and more violent imagery and rhetoric. Rudolph was pilled before being pilled was a thing. He's the reality you get when you continue down the right-wing extremist ideology so popular today amongst media and internet personalities and Republican representatives. An overview of topics that will be discussed. First, Eric Rudolph's crimes. From Eric Rudolph's perspective and eyewitness perspectives. Second, Eric Rudolph's beliefs. Communism, feminism and abortion, Christian identity, the Patriot Movement. There's many things included in this, as Rudolph is more than happy to share his beliefs with whomever will listen. Ties to modern politics, the Tea Party movement, MAGA. In words, if not deed, and movements, and by that I mean looking at rhetoric from campaign ads, modern Republican politicians, as well as movements surrounding them, such as those mentioned before, the Oath Keepers, for instance. And then we'll form conclusions, reiterating Rudolph's ideas and Rudolph's actions and what they mean today. Continuing with a general introduction, Eric Rudolph is a right-wing terrorist currently serving consecutive life sentences for multiple bombings. Eric Rudolph grew up with far-right Christian influences. He targeted the Olympics as a symbol of socialism and one world government. Rudolph targeted the Other Side nightclub for grievances against the LGBTQ community, feminism, and what he called egalitarians, Marxists. He targeted abortion clinics for religious and ethical reasons, connected to an underlying critique of Marxism tied to the free love movement and feminism. So, what exactly were his crimes? His first attack was on Centennial Park, and this was the center, the hub, again, for the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. He killed two people and injured 111 people. Following that, Eric Rudolph attacked the Northside Family Planning Clinic. This was in Sandy Springs, Georgia, a suburb outside of Atlanta. There were six injuries, two of which were critical. Following the Sandy Springs attack, Eric Rudolph planted bombs outside the Other Side nightclub. Five injuries occurred, one being critical. And lastly, Eric Rudolph set bombs at the New Woman All Women's Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama. This resulted in one death and one severe injury. Rudolph's perspective. As noted before, Eric Rudolph is unique because he provides us with copious amounts of primary source material. That having been said, we need to understand what we're looking at if we choose to delve into it. Rudolph's writings are biased. His accounts of the bombings, what he chose to minimize or leave out, and what he chose to emphasize all serve a purpose and goal. His biography, Between the Lines Adrift, attempts to create something akin to an action novel. He includes flashbacks and transitions and storylines. He includes some descriptive writing and attempts at drama. It's his controlled narrative. Objectively, Rudolph fails to make himself into an 80s action hero. He leaves out some of the more ridiculous things, like his costumes that were obvious to eyewitnesses. He brushes off minor flaws, such as informing a 911 agent that his bomb would detonate after it was actually timed to. And that could have possibly caused deaths of innocent victims. He leaves out his failures. He over-exaggerates his barriers. A great example is when he talks about his school experience, which is really there to serve as an anti-integration and, interestingly enough, early anti-CRT style rant, which again ends in kind of Bircher-esque Marxist conspiracies. The essays are on a site owned by Army of God. According to the Department of Justice and Department of Homeland Security's Joint Terrorism Knowledge Base, the Army of God is an active underground terrorist organization. So I won't advocate poking around their site. I already did so that you wouldn't have to. Overall, his work isn't worth reading unless you want to view it from a critical or scholarly perspective to better understand right-wing extremism. His autobiography is especially troublesome. I'll admit that it took me a while to understand that the amount of detail he was putting into the bomb construction, collection of bomb-making materials, and bomb planning was purposeful. It was a training manual. Childhood and his mother's interview. Rudolph flashes back and forth between discussing events and his childhood. I'm sure it's an attempt to make him relatable and build a story arc. His mother, Patricia Murphy, was born in Philadelphia. She seems to have been a spiritual person who had enough of an open mind to question theology, but as we will see, a closed enough mind to get wrapped up in Christian identity movements. Rudolph talks about her religious faith, but mostly to push his own views. Basically, he uses his subject as a way to advance his opinion that Vatican II was wrongheaded and done to appease Marxist forces. We should note that most conspiracy circles include Marxism as being synonymous with being Jewish. And that's why Mel Gibson got anti-Semitic super fast back in 2006. Vatican II conspiracy usually ends up in a metaphorical or literal anti-Semitic place. His mother, Patricia, moved to New York City to do work with Dorothy Day's Catholic workers. Rudolph described Dorothy Day as a, quote, former Marxist atheist. Day joined the Catholic Church after being impregnated and abandoned by her Marxist boyfriend. Rudolph's father, Bob Rudolph, was from Missouri. And he and Patricia apparently met at a commune in Brookfield, Massachusetts, before moving to Missouri. His father later got a job with TWA that landed the family in Florida. All in all, he describes his childhood as somewhat idealistic and suburban. School. Rudolph used these portions of his biography to incorporate his issues with education. And he had many, and they stretch back to basically elementary school and don't stop all the way through college. I'll touch upon aspects of this throughout, but in summary, he believed that all public education and university-level education had been hijacked by any number of boogeymen, which we will just call Marxist for ease. His first negative experience was apparently in third grade, and who knows the validity of it. He objected to his teacher, Mrs. Weaver, discussing atrocities committed by European settlers against Native peoples, she herself being Navajo. He objected to her having images of Muhammad Ali and Cesar Chavez in the classroom. This, to him, was an attack because he was white. It seemed like his father confirmed this. At one point, Rudolph described his father's reaction to this teacher by telling a young Rudolph that she was talking specifically about him, that he was bad because he was white. The section is all pretty disingenuous. He at one point claims he didn't understand what white people were and thought that he was being recruited to go fight them. And like so many right-wing extremists, he combines all these different things. For instance, at one point he stated, in quote, if, for example, the pro-life movement were to get its way and Roe v. Wade were overturned tomorrow, the liberals wouldn't stop polluting our schools with homosexuality. They wouldn't stop flooding our country with third world aliens. They wouldn't stop trying to sell out our country to the United Nations. So we have a combination of abortion, LGBTQ rights, immigration, and one world government conspiracy all wrapped up neatly into a narrative. And we'll talk about how Rudolph used education to push his other extremist views later. But it is enlightening to see how professional CRT grifters in 2022 use much of the same language and framing of narrative as Rudolph, a terrorist. Rudolph speaks about Christian identity minimally. He downplays his involvement in it. However, the reality is that his mother at one point moved the family onto a Christian identity-led compound. Rudolph mentored under a leader within the movement, and Rudolph was involved in seminars and trainings. We'll talk more about Christian identity, but in short, it is a racist form of Christianity that claims Caucasians are the real descendants of Jesus, and other people, such as Jewish people, are a cursed offspring of Cain. Patricia Rudolph, Eric's mother, was interviewed by CNN in 2005. In the interview, she discussed her shared distrust of the government with her sons, but she said she did not approve of how he expressed it by detonating bombs. This attitude and sentiment expressed by Patricia Rudolph is reminiscent of that from a father who was interviewed on the podcast Sounds Like Hate. The episode was on The Base. The father discussed how he felt helpless over his son's radicalization. In reality, he provided his son with property and a hands-off approach that resulted in the creation of a training ground and home base for neo-Nazis and white nationalists. The father took no responsibility. Patricia seems similar in that she facilitated much of Eric's radicalization. In fact, she played much more of a role. Patricia seems to have been the key motivator or persuader for moving the family into more and more extreme Pentecostal religious sects, ending in Christian identity. She allowed Eric to become involved in the John Birch Society, Birchism having started in the 1960s as a reactionary force against civil rights movements and promoting Marxist conspiracies. He was so involved that he was participating in retreats with the group. At these retreats, he was introduced to militants, he was taught about weapons, and he learned about the broader patriot movement that was happening around him. As we will see, there were open family discussions that went unchallenged regarding anti-Semitic conspiracies and racist stereotypes. Patricia did not explain what she meant in the interview regarding agreeing with her son about the government, and she did not discuss the inherent racist ideologies included in Christian identity. Deborah Rudolph, who married and later divorced one of Eric's brothers, talked about her experiences with the family. The family believed in numerous conspiracies. They walked the walk and talked the talk. They used a water distiller due to fluoride in tap water, or in case there is a quote-unquote invasion. Joel, Eric's brother, believed Jewish people were running the country. There were white supremacist magazines and literature in the family library, one being Thunderbolt magazine. Holocaust denial was another topic common in the household amongst the brothers. Eric would always get upset at depictions of interracial couples or gay couples on television. Eric would talk about hierarchies and Friedrich Nietzsche. He would justify Hitler not only in anti-Semitism, but in the notion that the strong can kill the weak. So this helped shape where Rudolph came from and how Rudolph acted. They aren't things someone would just make up, but they are all tied to themes in modern right-wing extremist research. Rudolph provides an array of insight into right-wing extremism in the 1990s and how it manifests in popular mainstream culture today. Oftentimes, perhaps more often than not, right-wing extremism doesn't present itself as part of a group like The Base. Instead, there are pieces of ideas that are all shared in one way or another, but to differing degrees with various goals and manifestations. We will see that because Rudolph, people who knew him and eyewitnesses gave us so much content to work with that there can be ties made from his beliefs throughout the right-wing ecosystem, ranging from Jordan Peterson's use of Nietzsche and hierarchies to anti-CRT group scripts. Rudolph ties events and public education to social engineering, forcing of race assimilation, and ultimately Marxism. While these concepts each deserve their own episode, which is something I might consider in the future, I think it's important to point these out here. When talking about a right-wing terrorist who detonated multiple bombs, to show how extreme these beliefs are and how they've become so normalized. At each step of the way, he portrays himself as an innocent victim. When he was young, it was the abuse of a child and older Marxist professors who wouldn't listen to his reason and logic later in life. On a grander scale, this was part of a larger plot to undermine Western civilization, at least according to Eric. As Rudolph put it, the ancients believed that a man required discipline in the virtues before he could tell right from wrong. Whether or not something felt good was irrelevant. Reason was the guide to correct conduct, not emotion. Men courted women for the purpose of marriage and family. Fidelity to your family and country were expected. Adultery, incest, pedophilia, and homosexuality were condemned. Murder, infanticide, and abortion were evil. Theft, lying, and taking more than your fair share were considered injustices. Work was considered a blessing, an expression of a man's worth to his family and his community. Patriotism was the highest social virtue. Military heroes, the most revered members of the community. And no life was thought to be complete without showing proper piety to God. Of course, not everyone lived up to these standards. In fact, most folks fell short. And in his view, within a generation or two, the counterculture succeeded in taking us back to the Stone Age. We were modern-day cavemen who lived only to satisfy our basic needs. We lacked discipline, ambition, or purpose. We hated all authority figures. We were incapable of acting from motives of patriotism, duty, or anything that went beyond the next bong hit. That statement, in one way or another, has been reiterated by many, many current right-wing personalities. And while that's a lot to take in, a lot to digest, I think it's important to step back and look at, because these were the expectations, or that was a norm for which Eric Rudolph believed public education should live, within the confines of those ideas. And in terms of modern CRT type discussions, I think it's worthwhile asking what norms or within what framework, global view discussions, do those folks wish public education to live in as well? Essentially, Rudolph claims that races naturally separate, which is why there were white schools and there were black schools. Of course, we know this is ridiculous, and he doesn't go into too much detail about this in his autobiography. Instead, he focuses on the government forcing integration almost as a social experiment against nature. Any attempts to address that inequality are instead seen as an injustice to the benefiting group. Or, as Rudolph put it, if parents decided to live in racially homogenous neighborhoods and to send their kids to racially homogenous schools, then Washington bureaucrats would have to take over the role of parenting. And this fits well into language of hierarchies being natural, a la folks like Jordan Peterson, via perversions of Nietzsche, all in all justifying inequality. To create a truly egalitarian society, they would force blacks and whites together at the point of a gun. And, you know, in general, when Eric Rudolph is talking about his education, whether it's in elementary school, high school, or at the university level, he's not talking about his education, or he's not even really speaking autobiographically. What he's doing is he's using it as a vessel to express conspiracies. And I think it's interesting how he uses the term egalitarian. Really, egalitarian to him is just Marxism. But I think because you're not saying Marxism, this makes it much broader, right? This opens up the conversation. And what it can do, if you say egalitarian, it can encompass anybody that's seeking any type of equality, whether this be feminist, whether it be LGBTQ rights, whether it be civil rights activists. We already had an appeal to a natural order, which is also interesting. And to Rudolph, that natural order was separated neighborhoods, right? White neighborhoods, black neighborhoods. Of course, he totally ignored all the different causations of that, economic, social, et cetera. And he instead and tried to imbue some type of God-given natural law or something into that, very Enlightenment focused. And using the term egalitarian, you know, I can't help but think of how people in today's world, whether it's a politician using something a bit rougher around the edges, like the woke mob or something, or whether it's more refined, you know, like our intellectual dark web type folks talking about the postmodernists, right? When really, or neo-Marxists. It's just an interesting observation, again, seeing how language is manipulated to make it loaded with all this baggage and context, which when you break it apart and deconstruct it, is really just more Bircher-esque Marxist conspiracy. Lee Atwater discussed using coded racist language for Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign. In a recorded interview, he described the evolution of race, going from using the N-word in the 1950s to more abstract ideas. And one of these abstract ideas, along with taxation, was busing. While nativist groups and terrorist groups like the Klan advocated for a specific curriculum when public schools began to become established nationwide in the 20s and 30s, the reference point for when the so-called Marxists took over is really the 1960s. And maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not, that only a few years earlier, Brown v. Board of Education declared separate but equal to be unconstitutional, leading to the forced integration spearheaded by the Little Rock Nine. The next major flashpoint was in the early 1990s, as Rudolph began putting beliefs into terrorist action with the nomination of Lonnie Guinier to the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. That iteration of anti-CRT Republicans dubbed her the Quota Queen. And overall, it was surprising just how much time relative to the number of pages that were published in his autobiography, Between the Lines of Drift. It was a bit surprising to see how much time he focused on education, especially his younger education. We'll see that he strategically left some things out. We'll put it that way. But much of his rhetoric truly does align with modern kind of the professional class of anti-critical race theory activists. Well, Rudolph also had a lot to say about universities, However, to get us to the actual bombing events, I'll keep this brief as his ideas and tropes are very similar to what exists today in the right-wing ecosystem. Rudolph criticizes campus culture, beginning with partying. He condemns drug use, which is ironic as he grew marijuana himself. But what he really focuses on is sex and its connection to free love. By tying teens having sex to sex out of wedlock and condemning it in very similar manners as modern abstinence rhetoric and the weird semen retention belief kind of segments, he creates a bridge or a connection between that rhetoric of today to extremism. More outrageous personalities like Milo to Paul Joseph Watson have participated in these discussions. Jordan Peterson even got in on the action back during the Louis C.K. scandal by tweeting, "With all the accusations of sex assault emerging, we are going to soon remember why sex was traditionally enshrined in marriage, placing sexual assault on a deviancy tied to sex out of wedlock." While there's a lot to unpack, let's move on to the second focus of Rudolph's ire, which is university Marxism. He railed against the popularity of Howard Zinn's The People's History of the U.S. He railed against what he saw as Marxist teachers and students. In his words, he wrote a research paper that challenged ideas of European colonialism and its relation to Native Americans. He claims that he was threatened with failure by the teacher. Even his reason and logic couldn't change the Marxist system. Other perspectives he shared in this section of his autobiography included the supremacy of Western Christian culture, the necessity of cultural homogeny, and the concept that multiculturalism is inherently Marxist and only there to deconstruct society. Rudolph was quoted as saying, "It was clear to me that college education had little to do with learning and a lot to do with indoctrination. The communists didn't have a way to take America by force. They were taking it slowly through a process of re-education." And that's a popular trope today as well, especially with internet personalities. Just tweak it a little bit and say, the communists couldn't win economically. And so they're slowly winning through a process of re-education. Now, here's some, I guess what you would call fact checking about the topics that we discussed. Through all the grievances that were expressed by Eric Rudolph in his education experience, Eric Rudolph mostly attended private Christian schools. It appears that only when his family moved was he integrated into public schools, which wouldn't last long, inevitably resulting in him transitioning to some type of private Christian school. Eric never even graduated high school, and there's no shame in that. However, he did drop out of high school, obtaining a GED. One of the main reasons or contention or flashpoints for this was his authoring a Holocaust denial paper. So this is a type of reason and logic that he's talking about. For all the amount that he amount of effort that he uses trying to separate himself from the Christian identity movement, he lived on a compound. He mentored under a leader within the movement. And, you know, all this type of rhetoric that he has about the 60s and free love and about how all these different concepts that came out of that, whether it be gay rights or, you know, second wave feminism, all these things that he just calls Marxist and deviant. You know, I mean, Rudolph joined the army after dropping out of high school, and he was discharged for marijuana use. So this is what I mean. This is what I meant when earlier I said that, you know, his content isn't really necessarily worth looking at. I mean, first of all, it's not even necessarily safe to do so, but the content is all biased. And it's so biased that unless you're looking at this academically, there's really no purpose in looking at it at all. And something else about Rudolph, you know, in his autobiography, he tries to say that he's not racist. He clearly is. However, he makes a half-hearted effort to try to show that he's not, reminiscent of some of the rhetorical tricks the alt-right used maybe back in 2015. I'm not really racist, but. And much of that conversation stems from the fact that it's very out there that Eric Rudolph was a part of the Christian Identity Movement. Just to counteract some of his claims, the Anti-Defamation League, in their archives, collected many responses to real time. So in the 1990s, real responses to the actions of Eric Rudolph. And these all came from Christian identity groups, neo-Nazi groups, etc. One of them is a posting on the website of the Pennsylvania faction of Aryan Nation, the Christian identity neo-Nazi group, lamenting that Rudolph was captured and called him a hero. Let his enemies gloat, for their days are numbered. There will always be another to fill the shoes of a fallen hero. The enemy has not won and will never win. Another one recorded by the ADL in reaction to Eric Rudolph's actions in the 1990s. A skinhead from Atlantic City lamented on a neo-Nazi message board that another good, solid white warrior becomes another prisoner of war. We need more lone wolves, way more. And I find that interesting. One, because there's a pretty obvious spelling error in it, but two, more importantly, because it just completely blows up the idea or the concept of the lone wolf, which has been used for the past 30 years to essentially excuse or separate mainstream conservatives from the actions of right-wing extremists. They're lone wolves. There's no cohesive ideology. They're all just crazies. No. On the White Revolution message board, it said, he rid this world of some degenerate scum in a couple of his bombings and made the government spend millions of dollars finding him. That is all that really matters to me. One day, all the lies, deceit, and purposeful destruction of the white race will come back at them tenfold. Centennial Park. His accounts of the bombing amount to a training manual and way to control the narrative. This is a huge topic, and Rudolph goes into great detail describing the bombing. Rudolph describes his time in Western North Carolina testing bombs, how he set up his trailer to monitor people who might be sneaking around, how he made bombs, tested bombs, obtained materials for bombs, how he cased Centennial Park, how he checked security. And it became apparent that the document was akin to a training manual. The election of Bill Clinton seemed to be the spark that prompted Rudolph from rhetoric to action. While this is speculative, it wouldn't be the first time an election of a president seemed to be the crossing of an imaginary line in the mind of a right-wing extremist, as we saw with Jim Acheson and the Unitarian Universalist Church shooting after the election of Barack Obama in a previous episode. There isn't much need to delve deeply into Rudolph's portrayal of Bill Clinton, as it's basic culture war standard stuff. But some specific things that Rudolph called out. Rudolph labeled Clinton a drug-using Marxist, kind of dovetailing off of his gripes about university culture. He claimed that Clinton wanted to destroy patriotism and the patriarchal family unit. And I'm assuming that that's an extension off of LGBTQ rights. Following up on that, a grievance expressed by Rudolph would be LGBTQ in the military. And by that, what he's talking about is don't ask, don't tell policy. Rudolph calls out socialized medicine. He doesn't go in depth about what that means, but I'm assuming it would probably be around the Hillary care debate, which was certainly not socialized medicine. But the ban on assault weapons, which did occur and which triggered a paranoid reaction by many individuals and groups within the broader patriot movement of the 1990s. Events that surrounded Waco, Texas, involving the Branch Davidians and Ruby Ridge with Randy Weaver. And overall, this general paranoia, neurosis of global elites overthrowing the Constitution to establish a global government. And that type of rhetoric you can hear today, ranging from places like QAnon to, well, GOP candidates. And Rudolph rationalizes and connects all of this back to the central concept that America was under attack by various forms of Marxism, or perhaps what he might call egalitarians, whether it be economic or cultural. Key targets of these Marxists were educational institutions and the traditional family unit, manifesting acceptance of abortion, gay rights, civil rights, and undermining Western civilization. These are all in one way or another familiar concepts promoted by right-wing media, internet personalities, and Republican elected officials. In response to his grievances, Rudolph decided to take action when, in his mind, others would not. He decided to attack high-profile symbols, such as women's health clinics, which he called abortion mills, gay nightclubs, which he called sodomite organizations, and agents of the federal government. He hoped his actions would bridge the gap between the patriot movement's rhetoric and action. Ultimately, he hoped he would cause a revolt to overthrow the so-called elitist liberal establishment in America. And building on this, Rudolph felt that Republican leaders were not doing enough politically, and we'll look at that later. Rudolph attacked symbols of what he hated, and he expressed that. He said of one clinic bombing, it's not the clinic that I'm attacking, it's the institution of abortion that I'm attacking. Rudolph hoped his actions would spur copycats. Essentially, he wanted more violence and more destruction. And ultimately, Rudolph hoped that this would lead to a revolution. Rudolph's first and most well-known attack was on innocent bystanders celebrating the Atlanta Olympics in Centennial Park. Rudolph portrays the Olympics as an exercise in globalism and multiculturalism, which to him meant Marxism. He saw the Olympics as akin to the New World Order, one world government in action. It was socialist in concept, according to him. His plan was to shut down the Olympics with a series of bombs over a period of days. This would be a blow to the so-called globalist agenda and also strike a blow to Title 10, which he incorrectly believed was government money funding abortions. Some quotes that Rudolph expressed in his description of the Olympics. The Olympics were a vehicle toward advancing a socialist model of global governance. He said that the Olympic Committee had acquiesced to this globalist agenda. And he specifically called Centennial Park the hub of activity during the 1996 Atlanta Olympics, a multicultural commune. Rudolph describes casing Centennial Park as if it were an action movie, and he were the protagonist. It is clearly meant to glorify his actions. He claims that he initially didn't want casualties, which is suspect at best. In his autobiography, he says that the goal was to plant the explosive and then call 911 with enough time for the area to be evacuated. Rudolph returned to Centennial Park the evening of July 27th, 1996. He had a light costume on, as he described it, and a backpack. The backpack contained a huge pipe bomb mechanism filled with nails. He also hid a gun for an emergency getaway situation. Rudolph got past security as he had done before in his dry run. He made his way through the crowd and left the backpack by a stage surrounded by bleacher seating. However, after that, things began to fall apart. Rudolph did find a payphone to complete the next step of his plan, alert 911 so the area could be evacuated. However, he mumbled and distorted his voice so badly in an attempt to disguise it that the 911 operator just hung up. Rudolph then panicked, believing police might follow up on a 911 hang-up call. After composing himself, he called 911 again, but had lost track of time. And he told the 911 operator that the bomb would detonate well after it was set to explode. Rudolph claims that he witnessed security and then a bomb squad find the backpack. He believed this to be a victory, as he was trying to avoid what he called civilian deaths. Whether this is true or not, who knows? However, the bomb was not defused and instead exploded, instantly killing an innocent bystander and wounding over 100 people, including first responders. Another man would later die from a heart attack brought on by the explosion. And with that, Rudolph accomplished what only Timothy McVeigh had a year or so earlier. Rudolph put Patriot Movement rhetoric into action. Rudolph had committed one of the worst acts of domestic terrorism in the country's history. Just as it had begun to heal from the 168 deaths caused by right-wing terrorist Timothy McVeigh, who we will certainly cover in another episode. In the article Fallout, an oral history of the Olympic Park bombing, Scott Freeman relays firsthand accounts of events. Michael Cox stated, "We were sitting on that bench about 30 minutes before the bomb went off, and we saw Eric Rudolph in the park. He really stood out. It was his backpack that stood out because it was huge. It wasn't a hiker's backpack. It was big and boxy. I remember wondering why in the world would somebody be wearing a backpack like that?" Tom Davis and Richard Jewell were working security that night. They described being asked to remove a few drunk folks from the stands and noticing the backpack. They shouted to the group, who had been asked to leave if it was theirs, and they said it was not. Davis noted that there were hundreds of people within proximity, and they immediately called for the bomb squad. Jewel began informing people of the situation and preparing for an evacuation. Jewel stated, "I'd been out of the tower maybe a minute and kabang. It knocked me forward and I fell down on my hands and knees. As I pushed myself back up, I looked to my right because that's where the blasts come from. Those troopers that had been lined up with those benches were flying through the air. It had knocked them that far. I started running to those. Hell, they're my buddies. I get to the first guy and I'm helping him lay down. I'm telling him, just lay flat, man. We'll get you some help." Jewel, who passed away in 2007, actually became a suspect in the case, doubling down on the tragedy of events. John Fristo was a stagehand who was injured during the blast. He witnessed Alice Hawthorne's death. Hawthorne was a former U.S. Army lieutenant and member of the Chamber of Commerce. She was one of the first women to be accepted as a member of the American Legion. Rudolph didn't mention any of this, or her specifically, in his account. John Fristo said, "Miss Hawthorne, I saw her. She was coming down the hill head over heels. Seriously, it was horrible, man." He begins to weep. "I'm sorry, I've never witnessed a murder before." Reading Rudolph's account, one would believe he felt remorse for the mass human pain and suffering that he had caused. He said the bomb casualties at Centennial Park were a mistake. However, before any empathy or remorse can be spurred, he immediately went on to justify his future attacks. You see, for Rudolph, it wasn't the fact that he killed people. It's that he thinks that some of the wrong people were killed. His next attack was against the Northside Family Planning Clinic. Leading up to this bomb attack, Rudolph writes a diatribe of resentment towards white middle-class feminists, very specifically. There is definitely resentment based on both gender and class present. He, like so many right-wing extremists do, portrays enemies as upper middle class elites. He ties abortion specifically to this class, both from a feminist perspective, but also as a population who receives abortions. He completely dehumanizes women. The Northside Family Planning Clinic was located in Sandy Springs, a suburb outside of Atlanta. Rudolph says the attack on Northside was to protest the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. He condemned the people who just protested and did not take action. This attack was much more coordinated than Centennial Park was. He left two devices with timers set hours ahead. Fortunately, only a few staff members were working when the first blast occurred at 9:30 in the morning. There were no injuries from this bomb. However, around 10:30, or roughly an hour later, a second bomb exploded, packed with nails in the parking lot, where first responders and federal agents were positioned. It was a booby trap. Fortunately for all involved, there had been two cars parked in front of the Bushy area where the second bomb had been planted. Those cars absorbed most of the damage. Seven people were treated for related injuries, but none of them were life-threatening. This lure and then surprise attack was much more advanced technically and strategically. This attack wasn't to make a statement. This attack was to kill people. Rudolph describes the scene prior to planting the bombs. He was sitting in his truck, listening to Rush Limbaugh, and praying, "Blessed be the Lord my strength, which teacheth my hand to war and my fingers to fight. He is my loving God and my fortress, my high tower and my deliverer, my shield and he in whom I trust. Amen. New York Times ran an article about this terrorist attack. It says, the early blast today on the first floor terrified office workers and sent them running for the exits. Investigators have not determined if the device was planted inside or just outside of the office building, but it was a second blast at about 10:30 a.m. that injured people. The explosion, first believed to have originated from a large trash bin in the front corner of the lot, sent shrapnel into one investigator and a television news reporter, apparently hurt his head when he was knocked to the ground. None of the injuries seemed to be serious, investigators said. Hospitals treated and released most of the injured by the afternoon, including two agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, an agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and a Fulton County firefighter. Not satisfied with his bombing of the globalist Olympics or, in quote, feminist women's clinic, Rudolph set his eyes upon a symbol of socialist egalitarians and sodomites by bombing a gay club. A hate crime bill that was being discussed in Congress also seems to have been an impetus for attack by Rudolph. And up to this point, Rudolph had written about how he hoped these attacks would defund abortion in one way or another. However, Rudolph's self-account veers quickly from defunding abortion directly into homophobia. The Georgia Voice conducted an interview with the former manager of the Other Side Lounge. Her name was Dana Ford. She and her partner, Beverly, opened a small business in 1990. The establishment became a home for many who had been alienated from their family for having come out as gay or lesbian. The Other Side hosted many different types of music and seemed to be a place to be on Friday nights. Dana wasn't at the lounge that night when the first bomb exploded. However, when she arrived, after having heard the news, she found multiple customers being worked on by first responders. The patio doors had been blown off, and the area was strewn with debris. At first, she thought it had been gunshots, but later came to the realization that it was a bomb. In that moment, another bomb exploded, just as it had at Northside Family Planning Clinic. And just as that bomb blast had been absorbed largely by a parked car, the same occurred at the Other Side Lounge. However, this time, it was Dana and Beverly's car that absorbed the blast. Beverly said, I saw our two baby car seats on Piedmont Road with glass everywhere and shrapnel. I'll never forget that as long as I live. Of course, Rudolph never mentioned these details in his portrayal of events. Rudolph's next bomb target proved to be his last. Rudolph described Northern Birmingham as a third world country, a shanty town. He blames this on the history of civil rights in the area, Martin Luther King, and integration. He cased a few different locations out until deciding upon New Woman, All Women's Healthcare Clinic. Rudolph observed the operations of New Woman, All Women's for 5 days before making a move. He left, returning to North Carolina for about a month before returning to conduct the bombing. Rudolph's portrayal of events leading up to the bombing are of unease and doubt with the plan. Who knows if this is authentic or if it's him trying to portray himself as knowing something was different, as this time he would be ID'd. The operation sounded like a mess. Apparently, he had planted an IED under a fake plant near the front of the building, along with some other small bushes. An employee who was walking in with security apparently saw it right off the bat. As the security guard got closer, Rudolph panicked and decided to detonate it, killing the man and severely injuring the employee. Robert Sanderson, an off-duty Birmingham police officer who was working part-time as security for the clinic, was killed immediately. Emily Lyons was severely injured in the blast. She lost an eye and suffered chronic injuries and pain from the attack. After Rudolph detonated the bomb directly into these people, he apparently said to himself, "May God have mercy on their souls." The bombing was the first field bombing of an abortion clinic in the United States. There is a story to be told for the manhunt that went on for a number of years. However, for the sake of time and focus of this episode, I've decided to leave that out. The long tale results in Eric Rudolph being caught. He was caught rummaging through garbage behind a Save-A-Lot in 2003. He was arrested on the spot. Later, Rudolph pled guilty to all charges in exchange for life in prison in a plea deal. Instead of focusing on the time that Rudolph was on the run, I'd like to revisit and hammer home the ideas that led Rudolph to the brink in which he felt compelled to construct bombs and murder people, all the time believing himself to be justified. Whichever belief you'd like to choose as a jumping off point, it really doesn't matter. They all kind of intersect and intertwine. They all lead back to the idea that Marxism is undermining the United States. From his time in the Birch Society to the Christian Identity Movement, from his belief that CRT was indoctrinating students and that universities were just communist brainwashing factories, to the idea that sexual liberation, sex out of wedlock, a woman's right to choose, LGBTQ rights, all just being assaults on a traditional family unit, of which, again, Marxism or egalitarianism or neo-Marxist or whatever you want to call the bad people. The bad people were attempting to undermine. And why? Why were these bad people attempting to undermine? Because it's an attack on Western civilization and Christianity. And that was really his main thesis. Rudolph even lamented that his logic and facts couldn't act as rebuttal against his foe. I hope that you're hearing things that sound familiar. I hope you started making the connections in your mind from Rudolph's extremist ideologies and modern right-wing talking points, however they self-describe themselves. Ties to modern politics. Tea Party movement and MAGA, in words if not deed, and movements. And so the jumping off point for us would be the Patriot movement. And Rudolph discusses the Patriot movement in depth. At 15, I wasn't really up on my politics. I'd never seen any evidence of an impending United Nations takeover, but what did I know? I had, however, done a tour of duty in South Florida's public schools, where the teachers taught us guilt and self-hate, where drugs and violence were the norm. I no longer trusted the system. The culture war that the Patriots spoke of was something I'd experienced firsthand, and unlike the Pentecostals, who had told us to become doormats, the Patriots talked about resistance. Talk of a coming war intrigued me. For the first time in my life, I felt like I had purpose. And you know, isn't that just quintessential? I mean, that's Hollywood script. That's someone writing the development of a terrorist. Well, Rudolph goes on to explain the evolution of the Patriot movement. He discusses in the 1970s how many Christians joined in opposition in social issues like abortion and LGBTQ rights. This greatly influenced the potential for a true nationalist revolution, according to Rudolph. Although they share these grievances with the Christian activists, patriots tend to focus on issues like income tax, property rights, and the United Nations. Gun rights are the big issue for patriots. Gun rights are not about duck hunting, target shooting, or home protection. To them, the Founding Fathers wrote the Second Amendment for the express purpose of keeping an armed citizenry as a check against out-of-control government. When they wrote that amendment, the founders were thinking of Lexington and Concord, where well-armed citizens took up arms against their own governments. The Patriots believe that losing our Second Amendment right is a final step in the conspiracy. Once the state has our guns, we can do nothing to stop the socialists from dismantling the rest of our Constitution and reducing us all to slavery. It sounds like any right-wing conspiracist in 2022, doesn't it? I was going to say Alex Jones, but not even Alex Jones. You can find this on any comment section of a mainstream article on some mainstream media platform. In a moment of clarity, Rudolph calls out conspiracy theorists making money off of patriots. Essentially, he calls out the early grifters. The people who talked about black helicopters and false flags that sell survival gear and food, it's Alex Jones, right? He states that conspiracies essentially neutralize the patriot movement and keeps it from action, like the action that he took. Like the Republican Party, in essence, Rudolph had disillusionment with the patriot movement. However, the patriot movement in a broader sense is important to the story. It cultivated Rudolph's beliefs and his extremism. It was a counterculture to its own. It was conservatives working from outside the system, which they felt was incapable of and not interested in listening to them. Groups such as the Idaho Lightfoot Militia, Militia of Montana, and Michigan Militia came to prominence. While many sources on the movement discuss sovereign citizens or anti-tax ideologies, they fail to delve into the deeply held conspiracies, the Bircherism, the anti-Marxism, the one world government stuff, Christian identity, racism, militarism, all the things that forged figures such as Eric Rudolph. These were the grandfathers to modern day Oath Keepers, and Three Percenters. This is where the Eric Rudolph story begins to get interesting. Up to now, really, we've just discussed the self-aggrandizing self-biography of a terrorist, eyewitness accounts, and historical facts surrounding that terrorist's attacks. We've talked about his beliefs and a little regarding how they are mimicked in various ways by modern right-wing voices. However, there is a line that exists from Rudolph and expanding out to include Timothy McVeigh and other right-wing terrorists from the 1990s to the modern Republican Party. Ideas that existed in various factions of the Patriot movement manifested later in Tea Party style Republicans, culminating in the modern GOP, which, as we will see, is not a center or center right party at the moment. Some of Donald Trump's most ardent supporters had roots in the Tea Party movement. According to Pew Research, Republicans who had favorable views of the Tea Party movement were among top donors to Trump's campaign. Pew also found those who supported or participated in the Tea Party movement had very high views of Trump, giving him a 78 out of 100 in February 2018. While the Tea Party presented itself as a patriotic and fiscally conservative movement, in reality, it was the place of birtherism. the Manchurian Candidate conspiracies, white replacement conspiracies, and narratives of cultural, Islamic, and Marxist invasion. It combined previously separate movements, such as anti-choice and anti-tax. It decried political correctness in the name of free speech and launched fringe media personalities such as Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh to success. It was the movement of movements for the right, and all tightly connected by, when reduced, what ultimately amounts to Birch Society anti-Marxist conspiracies rebranded. It was QAnon before QAnon, and the political groundwork for MAGA. It began holding Republican officials accountable for their lack of extremism, and it was the birthplace of the term RINO, Republican in name only. This is also the period in which various groups that were either directly related to or birthed from the 1990s Patriot Movement became politically active. This gave rise to candidates such as Ted Cruz, who drug along such groups as the Oath Keepers. Eric Rudolph wrote extensively about how he decided to act in violence because the Republican Party was unwilling to do so politically. Rudolph wrote moderates like Dwight D. Eisenhower worked for an accommodation with the new masters of America. They accepted the social democratic welfare state and ceded the culture to the left. They turned American conservatism into a stodgy, Burkean brand of classical liberalism, rather than a real alternative to socialism. Patriots believe that the country is already lost, and all constitutional efforts to win back our liberties have failed. America now belongs to a group of socialists intent on merging our country into a one-world government, which will be organized under the United Nations. The Tea Party movement was the house cleaning of moderates that Rudolph craved. It paved the way for extreme candidates and extreme ideas to become mainstreamed, all sharing the same core conspiracy-laden worldviews. Today, what was seen as fringe in the 1990s is mainstream right-wing rhetoric. The conspiracies and resentment expressed by Rudolph won Donald Trump the presidency. It's made media pundits on Fox News millions. It's escalated YouTube stars and fringe personalities from racist message boards to national prominence and into the cultural zeitgeist. The core conspiracies expressed by Rudolph regarding Marxism, CRT, feminism, LGBTQ rights, destruction of the traditional family unit, and an attack on Western civilization is normal, common, mainstream right-wing opinion today. Let's look back on this slide that discusses Eric Rudolph's beliefs. Feminism, abortion, patriarchy, Marxism, gun laws, LGBTQ rights, religious fundamentalism. The normies have been pilled. This is now primetime Fox News rhetoric. Nothing extreme about it. And along with the politics of the Tea Party era, the idea of fragmentation and groups being formed, the idea of the Patriot Movement, including many different militias and various groups, is also now mainstreamed. What do I mean by that? I mean that on your commute to work, any day of the week, you might see an Oath Keepers bumper sticker or a 3% bumper sticker, or someone at the gym with a Proud Boys shirt on. All of these gangs, and that's what they are. These are gangs and anti-government militias. All of these things, and let's throw QAnon in there too, operate openly and publicly as if they're anything but domestic terrorist extremist organizations. And where has that mainstreaming of right-wing extremism gotten us? Well, it's culminated in an insurrection. An attack on the nation's Capitol building during the certification process of electoral votes, which is a procedural method for a peaceful transition to power and a fundamental linchpin to American democracy. Present at this insurrection were the very fringe groups that came from or were born from the 1990s Patriot Movement, the Tea Party movement, and various internet movements too complex to break down in this episode. We aren't just talking about fringe groups joining a larger protest or a few politicians with far-right views. The way in which self-identified Republicans and Democrats view the events, which are an objective reality, differ. There is a difference in perceptions of reality. To reiterate just how integrated right-wing extremism has become within the mainstream Republican Party, on February 4th, the Republican Party censored U.S. Representatives Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger for joining Congress's investigation of the January 6th Capitol attack and Donald Trump's effort to overturn his 2020 presidential election defeat. The Republican Party, the official Republican Party, called those actions legitimate political discourse. In the opening paragraphs of the document drafted by the Republican Party, it states, "The Biden administration and Democrats in Congress have embarked on a systemic effort to replace liberty with socialism." The exact same accusation leveled by Rudolph and McVeigh years earlier. It isn't that these are coincidentally shared opinions, or that Republicans are all of a sudden terrorists because of this statement. So, you know, that's illogical and we can disregard it. No. This is an example of a shared belief system, a shared worldview, a shared ideology amongst all involved with historical roots. Conclusions. There's a lot to draw from Eric Rudolph's actions and his beliefs. I've expanded this discussion far beyond that of Rudolph's bombs and the time that he spent on the FBI's top 10 wanted list. And admittedly, some of this is observational. However, for as much as Rudolph wanted to try and portray himself as a man alone, he clearly is not. Socialization agents, from his father's views on his school teacher to his mother's involvement in the Christian identity movement, forged his identity. His outings with the Birch Society as a child, to being exposed to various elements of the Patriot Movement, helped form his worldviews. From the white nationalist magazines in his house to the open dialogue of Holocaust denial. And because of these, and the many more broader social and political movements discussed and not discussed in this episode, we also cannot paint Eric Rudolph as a lone wolf. He did not create his ideas in the vacuum. He did not act in a vacuum. And many of his beliefs are very much alive and well in our mainstream, normalized culture today. The lone wolf label isolates Rudolph and makes him seem an independent individual crazy who just so happened to share the exact same beliefs with so many other people in politics and the broader social movements and right-wing ecosphere today. It would be akin to saying all of the people that stormed the Capitol building on January 6th were just a collection of lone wolves. A piece of Rudolph's story is that he got what he wanted. Ultimately, Rudolph acted because he felt Republicans did not. The rise of the Tea Party, culminating in MAGA and the current state of the GOP, is really what Rudolph wanted so many years ago. Rudolph is a talented writer and well articulated. Reading his essays, I couldn't help but think of the many well-articulated social media personalities that present themselves with an air of intellectualism and authority today. However, I also couldn't help but see the connections and themes and ideas between them and Eric either. These comparisons should not be overstated to force a narrative, for sure. However, they cannot be ignored or dismissed either, as they exist.